Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to explore the latest on antioxidants and amino acids and how they can help you with mental conditions, plus how to live a longer life, literally adding 5 to 15 years onto your lifespan starting today. How can we do that? We're going to tell you. No guest today, so I can deal with some commentary issues. I'm going to discuss something from Matt DeBibi in Rolling Stone, The Legacy of the Iraq War, also from a professor, Azikiwa, in Global Research, Another Reason Why Imperialism Wanted Libya Overthrown. Two things happening simultaneously. New information I'll share for the first time on the show today of what might have been behind the actual assassination of Gaddafi and who. Also, Medea Benjamin, don't believe the media hype about Saudi Arabia's Prince Mohammed being here to help America, help make the Saudi Peninsula more of a progressive state. None of it is true. Also from the environmental segment today, how the Arctic is warming, and that's upsetting the ocean currents. This is very serious. This is from Climate News Network. Quote, a spell of unusual Arctic warming has seen temperatures rise far beyond their normal levels, prompting concern over long-term climate change. Well, it gets worse than that. It's not going to be stopped. It's tipping. And what happens when it tips is what I'll tell you about. We can see that probably this year. And we have some audio clips today, including we're going to talk about George Carlin on some cultural issues, since everyone wants to be so culturally correct, politically correct, and engage in identity politics. What does George Carlin have to say on that? Also, on this Skripal case, that's the poisoning allegedly by the Russians of this former Russian who was spying for the British, who is in, who lived. And they're all blaming it without any evidence. And one of the finest investigative journalists in the world, John Pilger, weighs in on it. Also, continuing with our series on understanding feminism today, we have Christina Hoff Sommers talking about feminist double standards. We'll discuss that. I'll open up our phones for you to have a chance to talk back on that issue. And our talkback number is 888-874-4888. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. From Western Sydney University, an article on antioxidants, that's your vitamin C and vitamin E and beta carotene, and amino acids and how they can play a role in treating different mental disorders. I worked for a number of years and was a friend of Dr. Abram Hoffer. He founded the Orthomolecular Psychiatric Association and the Orthomolecular Medical Association, of which Linus Pauling was one of the founding members as well. In fact, many of you might remember that I invited Linus Pauling and Dr. Hoffer on the same weekend retreat when we had our sleepaway up at Grossinger's Hotel. It was a wonderful opportunity to meet some people. Robert Mendelsohn was there. The who's who of the health field were there. People had a great time. I missed doing those up there. And Hoffer was a great intellect. He never started off with a conclusion and then tried to support it. He let the evidence lead him to his conclusion. And at that time, he said that we have a lot of people suffering from depression, anxiety, and hyperactivity in children and even in adults because we're suffering from subclinical malnutrition. Subclinical meant that they suffered no classical symptoms, like they didn't have enough vitamin C, but they didn't have scurvy. It was just above scurvy, something that the medical community had never been taught. How to diagnose sub optimal or subclinical deficiencies. And when we gave B-complex, we saw an amazing turnaround in people with different mental conditions. So I took it upon myself, since I was a trustee at Trafalgar Hospital and I also was research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology and Anti-Aging Medicine, I had the capacity to work in both realms. And we got a group of patients who had mental conditions and started giving them really, really outstanding diets and making sure that they had optimal levels of nutrients in their system, and especially vitamin C, very high doses, and B-complex, high doses. High doses meaning 100 milligrams once, twice a day, and calcium, magnesium in particular. Over a period of 1 to 2 weeks, you could literally see a complete change in these people. People had no energy, now had energy, because the B-complex is essential for creating energy inside the body. People who had heart arrhythmias were no longer suffering from those arrhythmias at the same rate because of magnesium. And so I shared all this information with Abram Hoffer. He came by and he said, "This is a big deal." It was, and he went on to write on it. By the way, this new study was published in Early Intervention in Psychiatry. So here's the takeaway message. This is from the study. Quote, "Nutrient supplementation in the treatment of mental illness is something which can be surrounded by both cynicism and hype. We conducted this review just to see if there was any real evidence if such nutrients can actually help people with psychoses. Certainly, there is every early indication that certain nutrients may be beneficial, not to be replaced standard treatment, but as an add-on treatment for some patients. One nutrient reviewed was taurine, T-A-U-R-I-N-E, an amino acid found in foods like turkey, and it found substantial benefit. Also, another antioxidant was N-acetylcysteine and vitamin C, also effective particularly for patients with high-level oxidative stress. The omega-3 fatty acids also showed improved brain health, especially in younger people suffering from what they called psychosis. Today we would call that hyper anxiety. And so they found, yes, it did work. Now, mind you, there's one little phrase he put in there. As an add-on to standard therapy, here's what you should know. All of our research shows that the antipsychotic medications do not benefit a person with psychosis or any kind of hyperactivity. They can depress a person's, let's say, response so that you're really numbing a person down. And that is not curing them. That is not alleviating the condition. But the nutrients can actually do that. And a latest study also showed that there's virtually no benefit to these antidepressant medications. Placebos work just as well. From the University of Kansas, they're finding out that dietary supplementation of DHA, that's one of your essential fatty acids, the omega-3 fatty acids, to a higher fat-free body mass in children. Now, that means that we have a lot of children today who are fat. And by the way, did you ever see any of those pictures of GI signing up in World War II? And they were taking their medical exams, and they'd take their shirt off, and they were just lean as can be. And now, 85% of all young people wanting to go into the military aren't accepted because they're overweight, obese. So we have really had a terrible problem with our obesity in this country. But when you're taking DHA, that makes a big difference, especially as young children. You reduce your total body fat. This was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. So, the takeaway message is children should be having their DHA or their omega-3 fatty acids every day and exercising, and we will have a lot healthier children who won't be overweight. I remember someone a long time ago gave me a little book and saying that Edgar Cayce recommended that if you had a number of almonds each day, you could help prevent cancer. Well, that was a gross oversimplification. I didn't pay a lot of attention to it because cancer is far more complicated than just the deficiency of some almonds or the nutrients in those almonds. However, what we do know is that all the almond, walnut, pistachio, pine nut research is showing some remarkable benefits. So GreenMedInfo, a really good source for quality nutritional information, looked at the scientific literature, and they looked at the standard American diets, and they found that almonds are really nutrient-dense. They have a lot of important nutrients your body needs. And they also took a look at what does the actual scientific studies show. Well, with the debate about fat consumption finally siding with adding more poly and monounsaturated fats to your diet, like olive oil, for example, we could be reducing the 600,000 people who die each year from heart disease, and by about 25%. How so? And because the statins are not saving lives, and diabetes is taking lives. One of the things you'd normally have if you have heart disease is diabetes, very common. So they took a look at an apple, and we know that an apple a day is very good for us. But if you took an apple, sliced it, and then put almond butter on it, then you have something that's really beneficial. And especially because raw almonds are important because of the quality of the fat they contain. They contain the heart-healthy fat. And so what I do, in fact, is I feed the animals that I'm caring a caregiver for. I take an organic apple, slice it, and then take some raw organic almond butter, put it on it, and they love it. Oh, by the way, another thing you can do, you take Ezekiel bread, which is a sprouted bread, so it has no gluten, and you first put olive oil on it, like a teaspoon of olive oil. Then put some maple syrup on it, organic maple syrup, which is good for you, and then put some almond butter on it and give that to your pet. Birds love it, and horses and cows and just about every creature loves it and goes for it. Monkeys love it, the whole family of primates, but it's good for you as well. That's what I call a grazing snack, meaning like I don't eat lunch. When my friends see it, they say, oh, that looks like mud, and they probably think it tastes like mud, but it's a lot of different compounding powders all put together. It's a raw living foods breakfast that probably is more nutritious than 50 of the average person's breakfasts. I mean, it's really good. And then I don't have anything else except throughout the day, lots of liquid, and then I'll have a grazing like what I just mentioned, or maybe some mixing some chickpeas and baba ganoush together and putting those on some avocado slices and squeezing some lemon juice on it. Grazing. And then have a small meal later in the day. And this whole idea that we have to have three regular meals a day is just nonsense. Anyhow, almonds are good, the fats are good, and it helps your heart. I'm a big believer in exercise. I exercise every day. And when I'm competing, I exercise generally twice a day. But we should all be out there for about an hour a day. And the older you get, the more important it is you get out there. Duke University Medical Center just finished a research of decades of Americans who are getting confusing information about the best way to counteract the health risks of a sedentary lifestyle. Like they'll say, walk 10,000 steps a day. Okay, that's fine. Now, who's exactly going to count 10,000 steps? Do a 7-minute workout from a phone app, or flip heavy tires in an arduous boot camp class. This is all nonsense. It's all commercializing it. It turns out that any and all exercise, even when done in short bursts throughout the day, could work to reduce America's risk of disease and death. That's according to the latest research appearing in the Journal of the American Heart Association. Quote, for about 30 years, guidelines have suggested that moderate to vigorous activity could provide health benefits, but only if you sustain the activity for 10 minutes or more. Now they're saying that's not just the case, that flies in the face of public health recommendations like taking the stairs instead of the elevator and parking farther from your destination. Those don't take 10 minutes, so why were they recommended? And this study found that even brief trips up and down stairs would count towards accumulated exercise minutes in reducing health risks so long as the intensity reached a moderate to vigorous level. So moderate exertion was defined as a brisk walk at a pace that makes it hard to carry on a conversation. So boosting that pace, meaning going a little faster, that then takes you into a vigorous exercise, and that's where you get your best benefit. So my recommendation is this. 45 minutes of vigorous exercise, 15 minutes of moderate exercise warming up and cooling down. You never just stop. You have to cool down. Let your pulse, your blood pressure, your blood sugar, your hormones all come back to a normal level. Then you can really benefit from it. So, yes, even people who are limited to being incapacitated, let's say to a wheelchair or to a bed, get little hand weights. If you can move your legs at all, then do crunches in bed, meaning bring your legs up to your chest, your knees up to your chest, and then back out again. And each time, see how many you can first do. Let's say you can do 10. Now see how long you can do each one. Count. And if you can do 10, laying on your back and bringing your knees up to your chest, and if you can do that 10 times at 20 seconds each time, so you do it slowly, bring them up, that really creates dynamic strength in the lower back, your abs, it burns fat, and lays down new muscle. But no matter what your circumstance, get your exercise in. The more exercise you can do, up to an hour a day, the longer you're going to live. From New York University School of Medicine, your gut bacteria determine the speed of tumor growth in pancreatic cancer. Now, this is something new for those tens of thousands of people who have pancreatic cancer, and it really devastates the immune system. So they're saying something very simple. If you have good bacteria, and that's where you really have to stop all sugar and meat and acidic foods, get into alkaline, raw foods, and good bacteria, I would say 40 to 50 billion bacteria per day, that will help substantially reduce the speed of pancreatic cancer, then allowing other types of therapies to work. And also, finally, from Florida State University, are you guided by your gut feelings? A Florida State University neuroscientist concludes that frequently you're functioning on a subconscious level, and that gut-to-brain signal is a powerful influence on emotions and moods and decisions, and typically prompting you to avoid certain situations. The published article in Physiology showed that if that gut feeling is guided by your, let's say, your intuition, more often than not, it's going to be right. So listen to what your gut is telling you, then analyze it, because you might also being motivated, your gut feeling may be coming from epigenetic fear and conditioning, where you've been conditioned not to do something or conditioned not to take advantage of a situation. But just sit and look at the likely outcome. If you do something or don't do something, your gut says do or don't do. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us.
with that suitcase. Hey, wait a minute. Listen. All right, well, you don't have to answer. Just listen. I don't mind when you say.
I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world from our environmental segment today. This is from Graham Ennis from Climate News. Quote, there are indications from the present phase of Arctic warming, tentative, inconclusive, but enough to arouse intense scientific interest to suggest that the planet may now be close to one of the significant climate tipping points that could usher in drastic change. At worst, some scientists now believe that the North Atlantic Current, the northern part of the Gulf Stream, appears to be slowing. The current transports enough heat from tropical waters to the Arctic to keep Northwest European temperatures several degrees warmer than it would otherwise be. If the North Atlantic Current changes significantly, parts of Europe could cool when sea levels would rise. Parts of West Africa could experience more drought, and the Asian monsoon might also be affected. Reports that the current may change are not new, but recent evidence from the Arctic itself has given this new urgency. So it goes on to explain how all this works. 9 years ago, when I started a ongoing series on the tipping points, one of the very first tipping points was, if that current that takes warm air from South America, the equator region, and brings it north up through, let's say it goes past France and England, Ireland, Scotland, Iceland, Greenland, brings cool water back down, if that slows down, you could see a substantial increase in temperature in Europe. And it would, now, it's not the kind of temperature that causes extinction, but what it does, plants don't grow. A lot of things stop growing when the temperature varies on a seasonal basis by 3 to 5 degrees. And it could easily go higher than 5 degrees colder. For example, if you have a backyard and you have koi fish, one of the mistakes people make, oh, I'll change the water. You go to change water with your koi, and then the next day you see, yeah, you got clean water, but all your koi fish are dead. Or you change the water when it's raining out. Oh, this is good. The rainwater will fill up the koi pond. Big mistake. Why? Because fish are extremely susceptible to any maladaptation in their environment. The water that's coming out of the ground is a different temperature than the water coming from the sky. There's a different pH in the sky water from the groundwater. There's different bacteria involved. There's different amounts of ammonia involved. And a lot of people don't realize that, wow, you have to have a good aerator in there because the fish need oxygen just like you do. Now imagine you climbed to the top of Mount Everest. You made it there. Tremendous human feat. And then a lot of people end up dying because they have an aneurysm, or they have a swelling of the brain. There's too little oxygen up there. Well, imagine fish. The only oxygen they have is the oxygen you're pumping in that water. That's why fish thrive around waterfalls, but they need oxygen, or they get deprived. You start draining ponds, you deprive them. So now imagine that the Arctic is ice-free this summer, which is probably going to be the case, completely ice-free. That means that the temperature is not going to be what it normally would be because the sun hits the ice that's in the Arctic and bounces back. That's harmless. You melt the ice, it goes into the water, shallow depth, goes down and warms up all that percolating methane that's been trapped in that cold surface of the Arctic. Now that methane comes back up, and that releases a whole lot more carbon dioxide. So that's how you get the warming, and then it's a feedback loop. So what happens then is that warm air comes down from the Arctic, down through Canada, into North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana. And what's important about South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, that's where we grow a lot of our heavy-duty grains. And now you change the temperature 3 degrees. You get it 3 degrees hotter on a daily basis than what it normally is. You're going to have a lot of seeds not going to be able to germinate. They haven't acclimated. You can't acclimate a seed in a year or two or five. So then you won't have no grains growing, because Texas grows a lot of our rice, but you'll have less grains growing. It's all on a scale. Everything's on a curve. So what happens is the extra grain that we grew there, we can ship over to countries that need it, that are deficient in food, calories altogether, and you will have less of or none to ship. So it's what we don't pay attention to because we're not involved in it. It's not as if that's the only food we can eat. We can go to a store and buy any number of foods coming from around the world. And that's the deception. Because we have availability of foods from around the world, even if they may be expensive, we're not going to starve. What about the people who are relying upon that? Not the case for them. We currently have 1.3 billion people, 1/7 of the world's population, who are food insecure. And we have 16 million children in the United States who are food insecure. So if this happens, and it's going to, it's tipping, you'll start seeing the effects, not just the slowdown, but if it should stop altogether, then it goes from being serious to a major catastrophe, mainly, again, for Europe, Northern Europe. And that looks like it's happening right now, and we should be seeing the effects of that in the very near future. Just a heads up, because at least you become aware of it. This is a question for the audience, for all of you today. This is from Rolling Stone, the current issue out today, from Matt Tabibi. It's called The Legacy of the Iraq War. Quote, "The invasion is no longer just one of the great crimes of this or any age. It's become a crossroads event in the history of American decline. 15 years ago this week, George W. Bush invaded Iraq. It was an awesome drama, made more thrilling by the seemingly obvious craziness of it all. People were looking at each other out of the corners of their eyes, shrugging and asking, 'Can we really do this without a reason?' That was the dramatic subtext of the invasion. In the press, no one could really make sense of the supposed justifications for the invasion. That it was compelling, no one could deny." And so the New York Times, on its headline, "Bush orders start of a war in Iraq, missiles apparently miss Hussein." And, of course, the person at the New York Times who was banging the drums for war was Judith Miller. Was she ever held accountable for crimes against humanity? Nope. She's even working on Fox. That shouldn't surprise anybody as a contributor. So what we have is, quote, "The gray lady who was playing such a key role in what was going on was certainly getting in the spirit, giving in to the adrenaline rush of Bush's evil gambit. It was the same with CNN's breathless coverage of that first night, with the creepy green-hued night cams showing explosives of the monster explosion one after another. Shock and awe, we called it a new plan for achieving rapid dominance. What a great Hollywood name. And people didn't sit glued to their televisions to watch it roll out. Yes, they did. Getting off like a bunch of kids blowing up frogs. Wars are great TV. The prolonged political lead-up, the decision to kill, it's all rich with suspense. And when wedded to the sight and sound of the bombs, after waiting all months for one nightfall at the hour of crime and sex to launch the first sorties from a secret location at sea, it all trips the senses. It's a turn-on. It makes the Super Bowl look like paint drying. The sheer drama is how they sold this thing to the public 15 years ago this week. But that's not how our rulers sold the war to themselves. They weren't overcome with emotion or some post-9/11 yearning for vengeance. They knew what they were doing. The Iraq invasion, one of the great crimes of this or any age, and destined to be a crossroads event in the history of American decline, was instead a cold, calculated, opportunistic power grab, aimed at much at what future targets, and even our own population, as to the Iraq enemy. As citizens, we haven't started to reckon with any of this. We write it all off rather than deal with it. In fact, when we think of Iraq at all, we often describe the invasion as a mistake, embarrassingly, even as Matt the BBC, even I did this a few weeks back, talking about how we blundered into Iraq. It's understandable. There are superficial plot elements from the Iraq narrative. We lean on to soothe ourselves that the invasion was caused by an unlikely confluence of accidents and errors, not the inherent finality of our own system. We remember things that look on the outside like a dumb miscalculation. First in line is the press corps that somehow all at once committed mass malpractice, falling for a plainly absurd weapons of mass destruction fable. It wasn't a systemic problem caused by a knee-jerk belief of government sources and the exclusive handout of network airtime to spooks, retired generals, and military strategists. No, we just all fell for the same error. Then there was the Bush administration, which appeared to sincerely believe we would be greeted as liberators in Iraq, and that we'd be able to establish a Mesopotamian Switzerland overnight. The Democrats will tell you that they were genuinely convinced voting for the war was politically necessary and that they really believed the intelligence about Saddam's weapons program. It was just a big misunderstanding, all of it. An oops moment, as some commentators called it even back then. B.S. The invasion was no mistake, and nobody above the age of 8 believed the weapons of mass destruction story. Anybody who says otherwise is lying. We all knew what was going on. Far from being an error, the war was a perfect expression of everything we stood for then, and still do today. And the survival of the comedy of errors explanation as popular media myth is almost as inexcusable as the original tidal wave of misreporting that preceded the invasion. America in 2003 already had a long history of violent regime change. One study cited recently by the Washington Post concluded we tried to change other nations' governments a mind-blowing 72 times between 1947 and 1989. Most of those efforts were justified under the disguise of domino theory, i.e., that we had to step in to prevent the cancer-like spread of communism. Well, the domino theory justified rigged votes, arrests, assassinations of elected officials, installations of military rulers, terrorist operations, sabotage in Cuba, even mass bombings of local populations. The death tolls from these operations are incredible. Millions of civilians in Indonesia alone. Of course, facing up to the shame of this blood-soaked past is not part of most of Americans' high school history courses. If you ever want to feel fantastic about being an American, watch this documentary showing Vietnamese parents weeping over their dead and napalm children while Dick Nixon tells the world that throughout the war in Vietnam, the United States has exercised a degree of restraint unparalleled in the annals of war. Or look at these maps showing the vast areas where we sprayed dioxin over that tiny agrarian country using bombers to dump poison by the ton, causing a generation of people to be left deformed, suffering, and alive with misshapen or eyeless heads like this. And that was our unparalleled restraint. That's what it looked like. So, and then it goes on from there. So here is the point on this. Show me the network, show me the reporters, show me the experts from the think tanks that came forward for months to demand that we do something. Show me their apologies. Show me those who have gone into Iraq, into Mosul, into the places that were devastated, and spoke with the people today to see that that legacy of depleted uranium cancers, deformities in children, whole neighborhoods completely decimated, and the sectarian bloodshed that followed with over, ready for this, 1.8 to 3.5 million Iraqis dead because of our invasion. That's genocide. And yet now look at President Obama simply saying we have to look forward, not behind, so as not to have to blame any of these people. So nobody has been held accountable. Now look at the very same thing in Libya. Nobody is held accountable, but there's new information on that. And the new information is, I just got this yesterday, that Sarkozy has been detained by police. And the reason he's been detained is because they have election rules in France about how much money you're allowed to select from anyone or to put into a campaign. It's a very small amount. I think it was $1,500. And he got $61 million secretly from Gaddafi personally. In fact, the person who got the money and brought it in suitcases of cash to Sarkozy has so testified. Now, Sarkozy is now in deep trouble. He was one of the people who really beat the drums for invading Gaddafi. And now, according to this new article in Global Research, it might have been former President Sarkozy who was responsible for Gaddafi's assassination. I'll read a short piece of this. This is new. No one has this information. 7 years ago this month, beginning in March 19, 2011, the United States Pentagon and NATO began a massive bombing campaign against the North African state of Libya. For 7 months, the warplanes flew tens of thousands of sorties over Libya, at the time the most prosperous state in Africa. Nearly 10,000 bombs were reportedly dropped inside the country, resulting in 50,000 to 100,000 dead, many more injuries, and the dislocation of several million people. On October 20th, longtime Libyan leader, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, was driving in a convoy leaving his home area of Sirte when the vehicles were struck. Gaddafi was later captured and brutally executed by counter-revolutionary forces, which were led, armed, and financed by the United States, NATO, and its allies, including France. France played an instrumental role in the destruction of Libya as a nation state. Then President Nicolas Sarkozy praised the overthrow of the Gaddafi political system and the execution of Gaddafi. All of the imperialist states and their cohorts told the international community that the counter-revolution in Libya would lead to an era of democracy and prosperity. These proclamations could not have been further from the truth. Sarkozy wanted the Libyan state eviscerated and Gaddafi assassinated because he had borrowed millions of dollars from the African leader in 2007 to finance his presidential campaign. Rumors and later documented proof surfaced to substantiate these claims. On March 20th, people around the globe awoke to news reports that Sarkozy was in custody and being questioned over financial irregularities involving the Libyan state under Gaddafi. During the period in question, Libya was a leading country within the African Union, where the basis for the revitalization of the Organization of African Unity, founded in May 1963, and the Declaration of 1999 led to the creation of the AU, African Unity, and in 2002, shifting the focus of the continental body mandating deliberations on the development of viable institutions encompassing more meaningful objectives such as economic integration and regional security. The spotlight turned on Sarkozy's raised again the question of the genocidal war against Libya during 2011 and the subsequent underdevelopment, instability, and impoverishment of the country and its implications in North and West Africa, along with the continent as a whole. Today, Libya is a source of terrorism, enslavement, and internecine conflict where there's at least three sources of purported authority. And then it goes on to talk about $61 million going to Sarkozy. So if Sarkozy was on this and he had French commandos there, And the French were on the ground, boots on the ground, and were leading the terrorists, then it's understandable. After all, Gaddafi had $160 billion in gold reserves. It was the number one country in longevity, health of its citizens, education, had the highest education level of any of the 54 countries in Africa, free education, free medicine. It had the best of everything in Africa and more liberation for women in Libya than any other Muslim country in the world. It was an enemy to no one. It was a threat to no one. It was the Paris of Africa. And so the United States, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Sarkozy, David Cameron, the Italian Prime Minister, they decided, let's destroy Libya. It had nothing to do with terrorism. Nothing. It had to do with he was wanting the, and he was the most powerful person in that African Union, to convert all of the transactions to the gold denier instead of the U.S. dollar. That would have cost the American manufacturers billions of dollars a year if everything was converted over to the gold denier. They couldn't allow that to happen. They stole the money because the Libyan people never got that money back. The United States collected it, and they destroyed him. Now, as of today, as we speak, Sarkozy's in custody, being questioned about violation of campaign. So, in effect, here's the interesting part. Sarkozy borrowed money from Libya in order to win the presidency and then turn around and was banging the drums to destroy Gaddafi, because if they killed Gaddafi, destroyed everything, who would have known about the $61 million? Well, it's come back, and he is a real punk. So let us hope that justice prevails. Just something you didn't know. What are your thoughts about this? What are your thoughts about where we stand right now in the United States, where we have so many movements of people running out from kids, you know, protesting guns and... But they're not protesting fixed elections, like the Democrats depriving Bernie Sanders of what would have been the presidency. No protest. How about protesting the surveillance state? How about protesting the fact their cell phones can be turned on and off by national security agencies? How about every television in their house is watching them and listening to them? How about all those cloud carriers, the ones that... give you all the information you want. All I have to do is what's the capital of Spain? And it'll tell you in a second. You don't have to do any more homework, no more research, no more reading, no more writing. You just have everything at your... It's also listening to everything you say. It's recording every single thing or anyone else that's saying and collecting data. They're not protesting Facebook collecting data and having it used. I see no marches for the poor children in America. So you're protesting guns, okay, that you're right. Do so if you want. But what about the poor children in your school that don't have a home to go to when they leave school that day? Do you protest that? Are you marching for the homeless children in your school? Are you marching for their parents who are living on food stamps and at some at $5 a day? Are you marching to stop home foreclosures? If you're a college student, are you marching to stop the usurious rates of interest on student loans? Are you marching to have that student loan forgiven? Are you marching against students who are being arrested in SWAT teams and put in debtors' prisons? Are any of you marching against global warming? I haven't seen you. Maybe you are. I haven't seen it. Are you marching against inequality? We're a nation that's feckless in our attitudes. We will all act like something good is happening because people show up and scream. When a group of Hollywood people say that, you know, guns are bad, and yet their movies are about them using guns and violence. So you're paid to use a tool that you're then condemning? That's why I don't listen to anything those morons out of Hollywood say. There's such hypocrisy. But we don't protest it. Why aren't we protesting any of the 100 things that we should that are important? That's my thought. I'd like your feedback now. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And I'll just give you one good example of this. When Occupy Wall Street happened, I went down. In fact, I saw no other journalist there. And I asked any other journalist there, and they said, no. It was on the first day. And I took a camera crew with me, and I was interested in their cause. And as I asked them, they said, we're protesting inequality and the major corporations. And I said, give me examples. Well, like, you know, Citicorp and Bank America. All right. So if I understand you correctly, you're against the globalization and neoliberalism. Yes. Good. And could you tell me something about your background? Oh, I'm a college student at Yale. I'm a college student at Rutgers, blah, blah, blah. And what do your parents do? 95% of their parents were professionals or upper middle class, lawyers, doctors, professors, engineers, architects, CPAs. And I'm not doing this to embarrass you, but could you please show me your wallet? Why? Just curious. I want to see something. So every one of them was loaded with credit cards. So I said, here you're protesting against major corporations, and yet you had the very credit cards that allow these people to make lots of profit. You're wearing designer jeans that are made in Bangladesh. Look in the color. Take a look. And one guy looked, and it says Bangladesh. I said, well, that's made by a woman making 14 cents an hour, working 18-hour days, and has the shortest work life expectancy until we're about 32 years of age. So if you're really wanting to help women who are being exploited, shouldn't you be conscious to wear union-made clothes made in America, at least fair labor? You're eating hamburgers everywhere. They were eating junk food, Coca-Cola. I said, do you think Coca-Cola is a humanistic, sustainable, green company? Or is it a multinational company engaged in neoliberalism? And what about your Tommy Hilfiger? And what about your Calvin Klein? What about your McDonald's or Pizza Hut? So on every level, none of this met the acid test of legitimacy. And then over a period of days, I went every day, people started, it was all about, do they have a tent? Do they have food? So massive amounts of food were being brought in tents. And then everybody had to talk together and as one voice. And so I said, you know, there are people from all communities, from the women's community, African-American community, Latino community, there's Native Americans, who have been through demonstrations, major prolonged demonstrations, and have been able to succeed in getting conscience raised. Why don't you invite, I don't see any of them in here. No, this is our movement. So your movement, you don't accept that other people who have also engaged in movements are legitimate. So then out from all this, nothing came except the 1%. But just understand something about 1%. There is no such thing as 1%. There are only about 3,000 billionaires on the planet. There's 10 million millionaires in the United States. There are, in the professional class, 17.2 million professional class that live as if they were millionaires, even using debt and credit. That's 100 million Americans who do not have to concern themselves with enough food, a roof over their head, or work, or clothing, or medical insurance, or a car breaking down. They don't have to worry about that. So that's about 28%. So if we were going to be honest, we would say 28% versus the rest, 72%. But we don't. So we try to super simplify it, 1%. But it's not correct. It's like saying unemployment is 4.3%. No, it's 28%. Real unemployment is 28%. So this is the problem when you get into identity themes with people who do not have the maturity, the knowledge, the sense of history, culture, and civics to understand the issues. All they have are slogans. And all I see all the time are slogans. Slogans don't cause change. They may cause you to have attention in a moment, but they don't move the needle. We're going to now go to an audio clip. And this audio clip is from George Carlin on cultural issues.
Something else I don't understand, motivation tapes, motivation books. What happened here? Suddenly everybody needs to be motivated? It's a fairly simple thing. Either you want to do something or you don't. What's the big mystery? Besides, if you're motivated enough to go to the store to buy a motivation book, aren't you motivated enough to do that? So you don't need the book. Put it back. Tell the clerk, you are motivated. I'm going home. And can anyone explain to me the need for 1 hour photo finishing? You just saw the thing. Can you possibly be nostalgic about a concept like a little while ago? Another complaint, too many vehicles. There are some families in this country own entirely too many vehicles. You see them on the highway in an RV. But that's not enough for them. RV is not enough. Behind them, they're towing a motorboat, go-kart, dune buggy, dirt bike, jet ski, snowmobile, parasail, hang glider, windsurfing equipment, a hot air balloon, and a small two-man deep-sea diving bell. Doesn't anyone just take a walk anymore? The only thing these people lack is a lunar excursion module. Too many choices, America. It's not healthy. Another abomination. White guys, over 10 years of age, who wear their baseball hats backwards. Something. You're never gonna be as cool as black guys. It's not gonna happen. You're white and you're lame. Law of nature. Turning your hat around and learning a complicated handshake will not make you cool. And you black guys, since you started the whole thing, I'm going to let you stay with the hats a little bit longer, but I think really, once you qualify for Social Security, it's time to spin down to the front again. All right? Men, the earring, the thing with the earrings,
it's over.
It's been over for a long time. Doesn't mean anything anymore. It was supposed to piss off the squares. The squares are wearing them now. Doesn't mean anything. It's just jewelry. Unless you have an earring with a live baby hanging from it. It's just jewelry. And I want you to know, I'm in favor of self-mutilation and personal disfigurement. I've always said there's nothing like puncturing and perforating your skin in a dozen or so places in order to demonstrate your high self-esteem. When I see a young man decorating his scalp with a soldering iron, I say, there's a happy guy. Thinks highly of himself. And what can we do to silence these Christian athletes who thank Jesus whenever they win, never mention his name when they lose. Not a word. You never hear him say, Jesus made me drop the ball. The good Lord tripped me up behind the line of scrimmage. According to these guys, Jesus is undefeated. Meanwhile, these are in last place. Must be another one of those miracles. And speaking of delusional people, what about a guy who hears a voice in his head tells him to kill his entire family, so he does it? Is this the only thing a voice in the head ever tells these people to do is to kill others? Doesn't a voice ever tell a guy, go to the salad bar at Wendy's? Something else I can do without, aftershave and cologne. And this disgust that men put on their bodies. Just what I need in the elevator. Some guy standing next to me smells pine tree. I said, go home and wash, you smelly... You smell like the urinal in a Portuguese cat house. Damn, guys are stupid. Guys are really fucking dumb. They think they're going to get laid with this stuff, you know. Oh, yeah, they put it on at home. Oh, boy, I'll get laid tonight. I'll get laid tonight. You don't get laid with green that comes out of a bottle, okay? And the only smell that's going to help you get laid might be your own natural scent. You have pheromones. It's a secondary sex characteristic. People in America, they're nervous about sex. They're going to cover that up and disguise it. Guys in Europe, they know how to live. Guy gets in the elevator over there, he smells like a pile of dog. Those people are sophisticated.
Let's now take a call. Let's say hello to George from Florida. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi, Gary. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, okay. First, thank you for the show. Really, really appreciate it. I will answer your first question. You asked before about why we invaded Iraq.
Yes.
Okay. It is glaringly obvious to me, and I have a hard time understanding why the rest of Americans don't understand, or their newscasters, or they don't talk about this. Is the only reason we invaded Iraq is not for oil, it's not for weapons of mass destruction, obviously. It's the same reason that Lebanon is incapacitated, the same reason that Egypt is destroyed, the same reason that we're in Syria today, and the same reason why we're going to invade Iran soon. We went into Iraq for the sake of Israel. That's my answer.
Okay. George, thank you for your input. People could agree or disagree with that. In fact, it's not what I believe. Leslie Clark, the former head of NATO, said that he saw a memo when he was in the Secretary of Defense's office by one of the generals there showing the seven countries that would be invaded. And this is pre-9/11. Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria, Somalia were amongst those, and we've invaded five of those countries. Now, what is the ultimate goal of that? I believe it's multiple goals, including regime change for those who would see that America and its allies could do what they wanted with the country's resources. And that's what has been happening since. In fact, just recently, the United States has shown that it is going to be exploiting the minerals out of Afghanistan to help defray the costs that we've incurred for that invasion. That would be about $2 trillion. So it means the Afghanistan people would gain nothing, but the private multinational corporations would. But I appreciate your thoughts. Is Israel a player? You bet. Do they have undue influence over our policies? They have a lot of to do with our policies. And now they have an alliance with Saudi Arabia to go after Iran. And there's a high probability, a very high probability, had Hillary Clinton been elected president, within 1 to 2 years, Israel would have had the green light to attack Iran. So I appreciate your call. Now, I want to offer something before we go that I have never offered before. I just finished it. This is something for those of you who love really deep conversations. It's a new series that we have called Conversations with Remarkable Minds. There's 129 separate interviews. These are some of the greatest minds on the planet. In-depth discussions on major problems, but more importantly, the solutions to improve the quality of our lives. 70 hours of conversations, because some of the conversations are an hour, others are maybe a half hour. I'm talking about really deep thinkers and body-mind healing with Jeannie Achtenberg and Middle East human rights on peace activism and human rights and recent events in Gaza by Uri Avnery. We're talking about the best of the best on conscious spirituality from Christopher Bach. All these, Bruce Lipton, you name them, Joel Bakken, and Maud Barlow on our oceans. So when you look around at all the wonderful things that we're doing, for example, with trees, the world's leading authority on trees and how they communicate with one another and what they're talking about and how they survive is with Diana Birchford Kroger on environmental forests, and Morris Berman on our conscious culture, or a lack of consciousness, what we can do. Lester Brown talking about environmental issues. So the important issues, the important topics, and the best minds I can find. Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at Harvard University, Harvey Cox, coming of age of the spirit versus religion. So this is a wonderful series. You're talking about the largest series of great minds I've ever put together. Now, normally, if you go up online and you find someone who's done one of these, they charge anywhere from $3 to $5. So realistically, you're looking at about $400. I'm charging $99 for the whole thing, and there's two ways to get it. We can send you the simple thumb drive that you can put in that has all of it on, or we show you how you can take it right off your computer. Conversations with Remarkable Minds. You could be listening to this for the next year and not listen to all of them, but at least you have one place with all the most important topics that we don't deal with in the mainstream or alternative media with the best minds on the planet. No commercials. So give a call to get your copy of Conversations with Remarkable Mind Collections. First time we're offering it is today. I'll give you the number to call in, 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. We've never offered this before. It's taken us a year to edit all this together. Our archivist, Sharon Pride, has been on this. It's now ready. Over 129 people, 70 hours of listening. No commercials, important topics, in-depth. The kind of in-depth discussions you just don't hear on radio. We don't allow ideologues in here or propagandists in here. These are just great human beings. Everybody should have this collection. You can take it anywhere. So if you're driving someplace and you're on a plane, you want to listen to it, you're taking a place to listen to a theme that you need in that point in your life, you'll find it here. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. And we're only charging $99 for the whole thing. So that's terrific. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.